Okay, welcome everybody. This is the third lecture of Production in the Market Process, the Mises Academy course, which is going through the middle section of Rothbard's masterpiece, Man, Economy, and State. Today we're covering, I'm calling it the second half of Chapter 6 of Man, Economy, and State, but it's probably actually more than that since last time we didn't get through the first half. All right, so as you can see, we got a lot of material to cover. Let's dive right in. All right, what Rothbard does at one point early on is he wants to show how you can construct, or not to construct, but how you can derive the market interest rate just going off of individual preference rankings. So the way that we did with the horse and fish market. Remember, for those of you who took the first course with me, with the horse and fish market, you had Smith and Jones, I think were the names, and they ranked horses, various units of horses against various units of barrels of fish in a certain way, and then knowing those rankings, you could figure out what the equilibrium price ratio between horses and barrels of fish had to be. And then if you added more people, that would pin it down further. And that was the way, going just from subjective preference rankings, you could derive equilibrium prices. And so that was, that's how subjective price theory works, is that you don't need to know anything about objective cost considerations per se. You can derive everything just from preference rankings. So when it comes to interest, the Austrians think that it is all about time preference. And so that's why Rothbard is calling these things time preference scales. And he's referring to this market as the time market, because that's the way Austrians think about it. All right, so we'll go through the mechanics first, and then later on in the lecture tonight, we'll come back to the big picture. All right, so here, let me just say at the outset, these diagrams are confusing, and there's a reason for it, and I'll try to explain why that is, but I'm not particularly happy with the way Rothbard did this. I'm not saying I have a better way. Well, there's a way you could do it that would be less confusing, but it would be more elaborate, and it would take a lot more space. But anyway, let me just explain how do you read this diagram. So we're looking here at James Robinson's time preference scale, and so what we're ranking here are different units of money, so ounces of gold, but notice Rothbard's taking the relevant unit to be 10 ounces. Okay, so that's one thing that might be confusing you right off the bat. It's the unit of analysis here is 10 ounces of gold, whereas you might have thought that 1 ounce would be the unit. It's not. All right, so that's one thing. Now, let's focus, first of all, on the present units. So, right off the bat, it's confusing, or second off the bat, since I already did it first off the bat, is that it goes, in parentheses here, first added unit of 10 ounce, second added and third is going down, and yet the units that you have are, the first and second are going up, so that seems kind of weird. What's going on? It's because you need to know what Rothbard means by these phrases. So here, this first unit of the 10 ounces means he's got some gold right now, right? He's got, I don't know if Rothbard ever says what number he has, but let's say he has 90 ounces of gold right now. This line set referring to the first unit of 10 ounces means, so you know he possesses it because it doesn't have a parentheses around it, and that's the convention that Rothbard adopts. If there's not parentheses, that means this person has this in his possession. So what Rothbard means when he says first unit of 10 ounces is the first units of 10 ounces that James is going to give up, possibly. And then the second unit means the second unit of 10 ounces he's going to give. So if he starts out with 90, this line refers to the 81st through 90th ounces of gold, and then this line item refers to the 71st through 80th ounces of gold. And so you can see that's why this is ranked more highly, because that to get to that position means he's already given up 10. And so because of diminishing marginal utility, the more and more as he gives up more and more chunks of 10 ounces of gold, the remaining chunks of 10 ounces of gold that he has on the margin are going to get more valuable to him. And so that's why you're moving up his preference ranking, because going up means it's more preferred. All right, so that's why those go up. But then down here, the reason they seem to be going the other way is because he's calling these the added units. So the parentheses, again, remember, means units that he doesn't yet have. So the first added units of 10 ounces means, if he started out with 90, and these are all in the present. So on the left side here, these are all present units of money, whereas on the right, those are referring to future units. So this thing in parentheses, if he starts out with 90, means James Robinson is considering, well, what if I, hypothetically, what if I were to acquire a 91st through 100th ounces of gold? How would I value there? Oh, I would place that right here on my value scale. And that would be, we could refer to that as the first added unit of 10 ounces of gold that I don't yet possess. So it's in parentheses. But then, suppose, I had done that, and then I added another burst of 10 ounces of gold. That would be down here. So that would be the 101st through 110th ounces I would possess. How would I value that chunk of 10 ounces of gold? Well, I would value that less than I valued the 101st through 110th ounces. Wait, the 91st through 100th ounces, which was up here. Because if you keep adding more and more chunks of 10 ounces of gold on the margin, the margin utility of 10 ounces of gold goes down and lower and lower. So that's why that's diminishing. Okay, so there's really not, it's not that something flips with marginal utility as you go from gold you possess to gold you don't possess. You would see that, oh, the first through the 10th ounces of gold are the most valuable, the 11th through the 20th are the second most, and so on. And then if you happen to have 90, nothing would magically flip. It would still be the 81st through the 90th would be lower, then lower than that would be the 91st through the 100th, and Rothbard could have put those in parentheses. I'm trying to decide if I should tell you why he did it this way. Because and from one point of view, that would have been more sensible if Rothbard just said, let's say this guy James Robinson starts out with 90 ounces of gold, or if you prefer, with 9 units of 10-ounce gold chunks, and then put in parentheses the 10th unit, and put in parentheses the 11th unit, and put in parentheses the 12th unit, and have them going down, and then show going up that the 9th is valued less than the 8th, is valued less than the 7th, and so on. That would be one way to do it. And he chose not to do it that way. And so that's what leads to this. So again, just keep in mind that that's true. This diagram is consistent with the claim that James values the first chunk of 10 ounces most highly, the second chunk below that, the third, all the way down. It's the reason there's this apparent switch is that here, this first unit of 10 ounces that doesn't have the parentheses means the first unit he's going to give up, and then this is the second unit he might give up, whereas down here, this is the first unit he might add, this is the second unit he might add, and so that's why they seem to go the opposite way. Okay, so that's one thing. Just in case you're curious, the reason he's doing it like this is it's, even though it's initially more confusing to figure out how this works, once you understand what he means and why this works, then it's easy to go from this diagram to constructing the supply and demand schedule for James Robinson. So that's why Rothbard's doing it like this, is that, yeah, looking at the preference ranking is confusing as heck, but then once you understand that, translating this information into looking at various interest rates and then figuring out how many units does James Robinson want to supply or demand at the various hypothetical interest rates, that's easy to get once you have it in this form. Whereas if you made this diagram that we're looking at right now, if you made this more user-friendly, it would be harder to translate the information from this into the diagram we're going to look at next. So that's, if you're wondering, that's why I think Rothbard did it this way, even though this is admittedly confusing. Okay, there's other stuff going on in this diagram. What's going on the right-hand side? The right-hand side, Rothbard is listing future ounces of gold. And he's putting those in parentheses to show that James doesn't have any of these right now, that he's thinking of acquiring them. So the way this ranking works, so you're putting this all on the same ranking. That's the important thing here, that the actor in one moment has preferences for both present units and future units of money, and both present units of money that he possesses, present units of money that he might possess if he borrows, and future units of money that could come into his possession if he lends out money today in a loan in order to get money in the future. Okay, for him to be able to make sensible decisions in the time market, he needs to be able to put all this stuff on the same scale of values. That's what's going on here. So what does it mean? For example, okay, this bottom entry here, the 10 ounces of future gold around with parentheses around it, he's saying that he values that less than he would value having a third chunk of 10 ounces of gold added to his stockpile today in present money. But he values 11 ounces in the future more than that. So if the way to interpret that is to say, suppose James Robinson initially starts out with 90 ounces of gold, then he gets this. Somebody gives him 10 ounces more right now. So they added the first unit of 10 ounces. Then they do this. They add the second unit of 10 ounces. So now he's got 110 because he started out with 90 and he had two different bursts of 10 ounces added to his stockpile of present money. So he's still in the present. Now he's sitting on 110. And now someone gives him a choice. They say, okay, James Robinson, we've already given you two bursts of 10 ounces of present money. Now we're going to give you a choice. We can give you either 11 ounces to be delivered 10 years from now. So we'll give you like a piece of paper that says the bearer of this paper in the year 2021, 10 years from now, can turn in this piece of paper and get 11 ounces of gold at that time delivered to him, and you're absolutely certain that that pledge will be redeemed. There's no question about its validity. It's just an issue of, do you want to wait around 10 years? So you can get that piece of paper, or instead we can give you yet another burst of 10 ounces of gold right now. What do you choose, James Robinson? Given his preference rankings right here, James would choose the paper entitling him to 11 ounces of gold to be delivered in 10 years' time, rather than getting another burst of 10 ounces of gold right now. All right, so just to anticipate something, Rothbard's saying, notice that nobody would ever agree, nobody would ever rank this thing right here, this 10 ounces of future gold, above current ounces of future gold. Because you could always just carry, you know, if you got present gold, you could just hold it for 10 years. And it would turn into future gold, as it were. So here, the reason he would renounce the option of getting another addition of 10 ounces of gold in the present in favor of this is because he's getting 11. So that paper, if he holds on to it for 10 years, will give him 11 ounces of gold, whereas what he's giving up with that hypothetical choice is 10 ounces of gold right now. All right, and so just to make sure you see how this thing works, we'll do one more. Suppose he went back to, you know, he originally started out with Okay, I see there's some question here. We're not talking about a loan right now. I'm just trying to explain these preference. We're going to use this preference relation or ranking to construct James Robinson's demand and supply curves. But when I'm just trying to explain these preference rankings, when I said he's got the choice between the piece of paper or this thing, there's no strings attached. I'm saying, so I'm going to give him a present. I'm James Robinson's buddy. It's his birthday. And I'm going to say, hey, James, it's your birthday. You choose. I'm going to give you either a piece of paper saying, I promise to give you, James Robinson, 11 ounces of gold 10 years from now, or I'll give you 10 ounces right now. No strings attached, no obligation on your part. You get to choose. What do you want? I'm saying he would choose for me to give him that airtight claim to having 11 ounces of gold delivered to him in 10 years. That's what these preference rankings mean. So now let's just do a couple more examples. Reboot here. Pretend we're starting from scratch. James Robinson is starting out with just 90 ounces of present gold. And we say to him, would you rather get an additional 10 ounces of gold right now on the spot, or a piece of paper saying you, James Robinson, will get 14 ounces of gold delivered to you 10 years from now? He would rather get that piece of paper than get another 10 ounces right now. However, if I said the piece of paper doesn't entitle you to 14 ounces, it only entitles you to 13 ounces, what do you want? He would say, oh, no, give me the 10 ounces right now. Okay, so just looking at these three items here, what that means is if James is just starting from scratch and hasn't had anything added to him, he would rather get 14 ounces delivered in 10 years rather than 10 ounces right now. But he would rather get 10 ounces right now than the promise of only 13 ounces in the future. So that makes perfect sense. That, you know, why would he value 10 ounces now instead of 13 ounces in the future? Well, because the 10 ounces is right now. He'd rather get gold now than have to wait around 10 years for it. But if the incentive is big enough, at some point he would be willing to postpone the delivery, and he'd be willing to wait around for the future gold if the premium was high enough. So if you're offering 14 ounces of future gold as opposed to 10 in the present, he is willing to wait. And, of course, if he's willing to wait for 14, then he'd be willing to wait for 15 or 16 also. Okay, so make sure you understand how that works. So another thing to point out here is that there's yet another distinction in the way Rothbard is denoting these things. So here, he's talking about the units, whereas here, he's talking about the absolute amounts of ounces of gold. Okay, you guys following that? That here, he's not talking about potential units of 10 ounces of gold in the future. No, he's talking about 14 ounces in the future, or 15 ounces, or 16 ounces. So I'm just pointing that out to make sure you're not getting confused. That is a difference. That over here, when he's dealing with the present units, whether it's units that he already has and might give up, or units that he doesn't yet have and is considering acquiring, the unit of measurement is always 10 ounces. These things are always evaluated in chunks of 10 ounces, whereas when he's considering the future additions of money to his money holdings 10 years from now, the unit of analysis is the ounce. These aren't denominated in chunks of 10. This is 14 ounces straight up, 15 ounces straight up. Okay, so it's possibly confusing to you, but you'll see in a minute why he did it that way. All right, so again, big picture with this. There's like three things that might be screwing you up. I hope I've talked you through it. Now you get how this chart works, or this diagram works. And I'm pointing out those things so you don't think you're going crazy. Those are, he is treating things differently. The way he treats present money that you own versus present money that you don't yet own but might acquire, he's handling that differently, because it's the first and second units that you might give up, whereas here it's the first and second that you might acquire. And so that's kind of a little bit weird, so that the numbers are going up this way, but they're going down this way. And then the other difference is, again, the unit of analysis here is always 10 ounces, but with the future ones, the unit is single ounces. Okay, but again, Rothbard's doing that for a very specific reason. So let's see now why he's doing that. So jumping ahead now to the next slide, individual time preference schedule. Once you understand how the previous diagram works, you can construct something like this. So here in table 12, what we're doing is we're listing hypothetical interest rates, and then we're saying at these various rates, James Robinson, how many ounces of gold does he either want to give up in the present in order to acquire gold in the future, or vice versa? How much does he want to give up of future money in order to get present money today? Okay, so let's look through this. So we're saying, so notice for one thing, it makes sense that if the interest rate is high, well, you know what, let me explain these headings to make sure you're followed. So why is Rothbard calling this middle column the supply of present money, which equals the demand for future money, which equals the savings in terms of ounces of gold? Because Rothbard's saying those are all equivalent. If somebody wants to save in the time market, what that means is he's got present money, and what does he want to do with it? He wants to renounce its use in the present, exchange it away for someone else to use in the present, and in exchange, he's getting a claim to future money. That's why he's doing it. You wouldn't just give up present money for nothing. You give it up because you're going to acquire future money. So that's what you're ultimately exchanging, and that's why Rothbard calls it the time market, because you're really just transferring your purchasing power from one time period to another. You're either giving it up in the present to get it in the future, or you're getting it in the present to give it up in the future. So this middle column here is saying, under certain situations, for a high enough interest rate, James is going to be a supplier of present money. I mean, he's going to come to the time market, say, I have savings, I want to lend out or invest or whatever you want to call it, because we'll see in a minute, it's not just money loans changing hands, it's also investing in factors of production. But ultimately what James is saying is, I want to give up, exchange away present money, so that's like the supply of present money, because I'm demanding future money. That's ultimately what we're trading here. I'm selling present money and I'm buying future money in the time market, and that's also savings. But over here, the supply of future money equals the demand for present money. And I think Rothbard could have put equals borrowings, but he may not have done that to avoid being misleading, and we'll come back to that. But for this level, this stage of the analysis, that would be analogous to put in there. So the one side of the market is savings, the other side of the market is borrowing. Okay, and so you see it makes sense that the higher the interest rate, the more likely it is that James is going to be supplying present money, whereas the lower the interest rate is, at some point he starts borrowing because it's cheaper to borrow. You know, if you want to think of it as the higher the interest rate, the higher the reward to saving. And so he does more of it. You know, that's the way you want to think about it. Okay, so now let's just run through quickly and see, where are these numbers coming from? How do these numbers, how are they related to the previous slide? So at the interest rate of 9%, this is saying James wants to supply 20 ounces of gold in the present. So he's going to lend out, he's going to save 20 ounces of gold, and he's going to do something with it in order to turn it into future money. So you can think of it as lending it out to somebody, you know, just in a contract, somebody says, hey, I want to borrow money from you for 10 years at an annual interest rate of 9%. How much are you willing to lend to me? And James says, oh, I'll lend you 20 ounces. Or James could go look at the structure of production and see the price spread and realize, if I invest 20 ounces of gold in higher order goods and wait 10 years and then sell the output, I can get back more gold than I put in initially for an annual rate of return of 9%, and that's what I want to do. Okay, so that's another thing going on here. Okay, but where does that 9% corresponding to the 20 ounces of gold come from? Let's look back here. So what Rothbard is saying is, at 9% interest, that is like a, and here Rothbard engages in a very simplistic arithmetical assumption. The reason he picked 10 years here, you might have wondered, wait a minute, if we're just trying to get the basics down of present money versus future money, isn't it more natural to think in terms of 1 year? Why is Rothbard making it 10 years from now? That's kind of weird. The reason he's doing that is he wants to say, at a 9% interest rate, if I lend out 10 ounces of gold now, in a decade, I get paid back 19 ounces. Because he doesn't want to have to say, if I lend out 1 ounce of gold now, 1 year from now at a 9% interest rate, I get paid back 1.09 ounces of gold. Because that seems, what the heck is 1.09 ounces of gold? That seems cumbersome. Okay, so that's why Rothbard's doing it this way. That's why he picked 10 years as the time frame, because he wants to have nice whole numbers. He doesn't want to have people getting fractional amounts back. Now, the problem is that's mathematically incorrect. It's not, with compound interest and so forth, it's not true that if you lend out 10 ounces of gold today at a 9% annualized rate, that 10 years from now you get paid back 19 ounces. But so that may have been something else that was throwing you off if you were running the numbers exactly. So I'm just telling you that's what Rothbard has in mind. Okay, so if you understand that, now you can see why, remember what we're trying to explain here, why if the interest rate is 9%, does Rothbard say James Robinson wants to save 20 ounces of gold and exchange them for future money? Because at 9%, that's like saying if you give up 10 ounces of gold today, you get 19 ounces of gold delivered to you 10 years from now. So Rothbard is saying, oh, okay, so would I give up this first unit of my 10 ounces, or would James give up this first unit of 10 ounces? Yeah, he would, because look, that's valued much less, or it's valued less than the 19 ounces in the future. So because this potential 19 ounces of gold in the future is ranked more highly than the first unit of 10 ounces that James could give up, he does it. So he's willing to exchange at least 10 ounces, but then we have to check the second one. So we check this. Would James give up yet a second burst of 10 ounces of gold in the present in exchange for 19 ounces of gold to be delivered 10 years from now? Yes, he would, because that's ranked more highly than that. And then presumably there's a third unit of 10 ounces that's up here somewhere that we don't see that's ranked more highly than this. And so that's why James stops. He's willing to lend out 20 ounces or to save 20 ounces, but no more. Okay, so now we've hit yet another problem with this diagram, is that notice I was referring here to the first unit of 10 ounces and then to this presumably first unit of 19 ounces acquired in the future. And then when I checked the second thing, I moved up here, and yet I referred to the same 19 ounces of future. So that's kind of weird. That strictly speaking, I should be looking not at the first addition of 19 ounces in future gold. I should be looking at the second burst of 19 ounces. Okay. Rothbard talks about that in a footnote, and he says, yeah, strictly speaking, I should be doing that, but we're not going to bother with that because it gets too complicated. All right. So again, there's a lot of simplifications going on here, and I'm just walking you through this so you understand what Rothbard's doing. And, it's up to you guys whether to decide, should Rothbard have taken 20 extra pages to do this more correctly, or are these five simplifications that we've encountered so far harmless enough that they're not going to distract the reader? That's, that's up to you. but I'm just telling you what Rothbard did here. Okay, let's just do a couple more to make sure you see the pattern. At an interest rate of 8%, James is still a saver, but only he only saves 10. He doesn't save 20. Why? Because look at at an interest rate of 8%, Rothbard's saying basically that means you could give up 10 ounces of gold today to get 18 ounces delivered to you in 10 years because it's an 8% annualized rate. So would I give up, if I gave up this first unit of 10 ounces that I have right now in order to acquire 18 ounces delivered 10 years from now, would I be better off? Yeah, because that 18 ounces in the future I value more highly. But would I do it again? No, because my second unit of 10 ounces in the present, the second unit that I might give up, not the second unit in my possession, is ranked more highly than 18 ounces of future gold. So he wouldn't do it again. He would give up one present burst of 10 ounces, but he wouldn't give up a second one. So that's why at an 8% interest rate, it's 10. Then the 7 is also 10 for the same reason. You can see the 7 is, you know, nestled in between those two. And then it shrinks. Now between 6 and 4, it's 0. We'll come back to that in a minute. And I'll just do two more here. Okay, at 2%, why is he supplying 10? Or sorry, he's like borrowing 10. Because at an interest rate of 2%, and we're going to encounter yet another thing that's confusing about this diagram, but here's what's going on. So at a 2% annualized interest rate, that means basically the things you're trading are 10 ounces of present money contrasted with 12 ounces of money 10 years from now. So if that's the trade-off that's being faced, look at what's happening here. The first added unit of 10 ounces in the present is higher than the 12 ounces of future money. So Rothbard is saying James, at a 2% interest rate, meaning it's 10 present money versus 12 ounces 10 years from now, he would want to give up this and gain that. So how do you do that? You're borrowing money. You're agreeing, yep, I want 10 ounces of gold right now that I don't actually have in my possession. I want to acquire 10 more ounces of gold right now. So he's like borrowing that money. And how am I paying for it? I'm giving you a piece of paper that says, I, James Robinson, promise to pay you 12 ounces of gold 10 years from now. Okay, so James, in this case, is borrowing money at a 2% interest rate. He's borrowing 10 ounces of gold. And then, just to see the numbers, at 1%, it jumps up to 20. Because you can see, at 1%, it falls below this thing, because that would be 11 ounces. So at 1%, if the interest rate's 1%, meaning you can acquire 10 ounces of gold in the present by sacrificing or selling a promise to deliver 11 ounces 10 years from now, he would add this and this, but not that, because the 11 is below these two, but it's above this one. And so that's why he would borrow 20, but not 30. Okay, so that's, but the reason that's confusing now, in case you didn't catch that, is so notice that even though he's got these things in parentheses, in order to explain James's behavior as a potential borrower, these things can't be have parentheses. James has that. In order for James to borrow 10 ounces of gold now in exchange for, let's say, 13 ounces of future gold, he has to possess 13 ounces of future gold, because otherwise, how could he do it? You know, how could he borrow the money if he's not capable of paying it back? In other words, what James is doing when he borrows money is he's buying present money and he's selling future money. So you can't sell what you don't have. So it's a little bit weird since it's in the future. And you might be thinking, you know, like you don't have it now, but you think you're going to get it in the future. And so what does it mean to say, do I have present money? You know, so that's admittedly a bit weird, but Rothbard even confirms, and I think it's in another footnote, saying that, yeah, strictly speaking, we shouldn't be putting parentheses around these things if James is supplying them, because he owns it if he supplies it, but we're not going to deal with that because he needs this to show both acquiring or potentially selling future money. So you can see how there's like five or six things that Rothbard did that were simplifications here, because once you understand how this diagram works, deriving this stuff is simple. Okay. So what I wanted to point out is, notice, and this is something that I never realized until I read Man, Economy, and State. So I think most people understand that, you know, as prices go down, people demand, you know, the quine demand goes up and the quine supply goes down. So when it comes to thinking about interest rates and borrowing and lending, you think, okay, other things equal, the higher the interest rate, people want to save more and people want to borrow less. And so, yeah, there's going to be, you know, the interest rate is going to adjust until those two things are equal, until the quantity of people collectively, the quantity they want to save equals the quantity that the other people in the community want to borrow. But what you might think is that for a given person, the interest rate is going to move, and then at a high enough rate, they're going to be net savers, and then at some point, they're going to flip and become net borrowers. And that's actually not true, that there is an intermediate range where they might neither save nor borrow. And so for James, that happens at the interest rates of 6%, 5%, and 4%, whereas you can see at those rates, he doesn't save, but he also doesn't borrow anything. All right, so I'm just pointing that out in case, you know, because like I said, I used to think the other way. I thought you're either a borrower or a saver, and just different people fall on that dividing line at different cutoff interest rates, and that's not true. And if you think about it, it actually makes sense because, you know, there was nothing strange about, you know, if that seems weird to you, just think of it like this. Your head probably didn't explode when I said that the interest rate at 8% and 7% both yielded that James would supply 10 ounces of present money. You know, your head didn't explode thinking, well, no, if the interest rate goes down, he should have supplied more. No, he supplied the same amount. He didn't supply less, or sorry, the other way around. You might have thought if the interest rate drops, he should have supplied less, and it stayed the same. And so I'm saying, well, that's consistent with the law of supply, is the, you know, the price of supplying present money dropping, that didn't make the quantity supplied go down, but that's fine as long as it didn't go up. You know, that would be weird if it went up, but it's okay if it stays the same. So by the same token, the fact that it's zero for a range there, so what? And then the fact that once it goes to 3 and 2, it stays at 10 for a while there, so what, right? So the point is, just like there's nothing magical about 10, and you can have it be 10 for a range, and then in a sense, negative 10 for a range, if you're thinking of, you know, his savings is negative there, there's no reason for it not to be zero for a range. All right, so I'm not going to go through it, but if you just want to go through these numbers, you can see why it is zero for a range. Well, I'll just do one of them, just because it is kind of weird. So it's 6%. He doesn't want to save, but he doesn't want to borrow. Why is that? Well, because look, it's 6%. And 5% and 4%, those are all nestled in between here. So this is the first unit of 10 ounces of present money he had that he might give up, and this down here is the first added unit of 10 ounces. And so these potential gains or subtractions, if he gets rid of them, of 16, 15, or 14 are in between those two things, you know, in between these two, and that's why, if you just think it through, if those are the interest rates, he neither wants to borrow nor lend. So, like I say, let me just, in case this is the way you guys were thinking about it, the reason that surprised me when I first encountered it is because I used to think like this. I used to think everybody's got his or her own time preference rate, and let's say mine is 8%, that I personally value present money over future money at a rate of 8% on the margin. And let's say Sally has only, you know, she's more patient than I am, and she has a time preference rate on the margin of 1%. And so, if, or let's say 2% for Sally. And so I used to think, oh, okay, so if the interest rate is like 10%, then Sally and I are both saving. But if the interest rate is 2% or 3%, then Sally is saving, but I'm borrowing. And that was the way I used to think. So I thought everybody had that critical line, cutoff threshold, and that the interest rate, the market rate of interest was higher than your personal time preference rate, then you were a saver, and if the market rate of interest happened to be lower than your personal time preference rate, then you were a borrower. And I just thought, you know, the market rate had to be such that there were balanced amounts on both sides. But that's wrong. All right, it's kind of right, but it's strictly speaking, it's not right, and for the reason we just talked about here, that don't think of it as somebody has his own personal number, and that's his time preference rate, and at a higher rate, he borrows, and a lower rate, because it's, things are more discrete than that, is what I'm getting at. So here, if you asked, what is James Robinson's personal time preference rate, that, you know, that doesn't really make sense. You can say at 7% he starts saving, and at 3% he starts borrowing. But does that mean his time preference rate is 4%? No. Does it mean it's 6%? Well, not really. So I'm just pointing that out because that was the way I used to think about it, and it's not right. Okay. So now that we got that down, we can talk about supply and demand curves in the time market. So this is pretty straightforward. You just go from this stuff. So this is James Robinson, and you can see it down here. So notice that Robinson contributes to both the demand curve and the supply curve. Oops, this is Robinson's and the supply curve. All right, I'm not going to walk through it. That's pretty straightforward. At any potential interest rate, you can see, you know, at high enough interest rates, at 6%, 7%, 8%, or 9%, these are the quantities that Robinson would supply of present goods or savings. And at low interest rates, 3, 2, or 1, you can see this is what Robinson would demand. And then Smith just supplies it. All right, and so what you would do in principle then is consolidate all that for all the people in the community, and then you just get your aggregate supply and demand curves, you know, or market supply and demand curves for the time market, and figure out what the market clearing interest rate is. Okay, so let's jump ahead now. I spent way more time on that than I wanted to. Let's talk about the law of time preference. So here, here's typical statements of it. You say other things equal, present goods are preferred to future goods, or you might hear people talk about it in terms of the actual satisfactions. So other things equal, an individual prefers a given satisfaction in the present to the same satisfaction in the future. So this is the Austrians, following Mises, and Rothbard picks this up, and Walter Block, and so on, believe in what's called the pure time preference theory of interest. So they think that interest is fundamentally about time preference, subjective time preference. And that's why Rothbard's going spend so much time going through this stuff and calling it the time market. He's saying, I don't, you know, remember the stuff we talked about last week, drawing on Bimbavrich's critique of the naive productivity theory of interest. Frank Fetter generalized that. And he said, there's nothing about capital productivity, that you're making a category mistake about what interest is if you think interest has anything to do with capital productivity. And he was a little bit surprised that Bimbavrich, of all people, in his own explanation of interest, relapsed into talking in one part about productivity. So like I said, I think Fetter is being unfair to Vimbava, but don't worry about that. For this class, you don't need to know that stuff. For this class, you just need to know the canonical Orthodox Austrian view on this is that, yeah, Vimbava paved the way and, you know, showed the light in criticizing a certain attempt to explain interest by reference to the productivity of capital, but Frank Fetter was the most consistent and just showed that, no, interest really is about time preference. And so that's what Rothbard's doing here and this sort of thing. Rothbard's point is, look, nowhere in this diagram do I have anything about the productivity of capital goods. And yet I'm able to construct supply and demand curves in the time market, and I can tell you what the equilibrium interest rate is. So just like, so Rothbard would think it was analogous to subjective value theory when it comes to the pricing of consumer goods, that a mainstream economist would say, you know, like in the tradition of Alfred Marshall, would say, when you're trying to explain the price of apples, there's two things going on. There's the demand curve for apples, which is just about subjective preferences and, you know, marginal utilities from consuming. And the consumers, you know, don't need to know anything about the physical technology used in creating apples. All they need to know is, boy, I really like the taste of apples, or my doctor said I need to eat more apples, or whatever. So that's the demand curve for apples. Or even apple juice producers need to know, if we have this many apples, we can make this many pints of orange or of apple juice and blah, blah, blah. And so that's their demand for apples. So there, nobody cares about where apples come from. Apples could just fall from the sky. You could, you know, take your tooth out and put it under your pillow and then you get apples the next day. It doesn't matter as far as the demand curve for apples is concerned. But again, I'm giving you the mainstream neoclassical approach to price theory. They would say the supply curve is influenced by objective cost considerations. That, you know, the technology involved, the fact that if you, you know, to make more apples, you got to use more land and blah, 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 and it's, you know, there's a physical yield and so forth. That kind of consideration goes into the cost curve or the supply curve. And so Alfred Marshall said, you know, this debate between the classical economists who focused on the cost of production or, the, you know, the labor theory of value versus the new subjective school following in the tradition of Carl Menger and Jevons and Walras, who are focused almost exclusively on subjective, you know, mental stuff. Alfred Marshall thought, you guys are both seeing part of the solution, but it's wrong to think it's one or the other. It's both. That you need subjective utility mental considerations for the demand curve, and you need objective physical technological constraints, resource scarcities, and what have you when it comes to the supply curve. And you can't say what the equilibrium price and quantity are unless you know both supply and demand. And Alfred Marshall famously likened it to the two blades of one scissors. And so he said, you know, you guys, you're arguing, you know, the people in the tradition of Adam Smith and Ricardo are saying, no, it's cost determines price. And you subjectivists in the tradition of Carl Menger are saying, no, it's subjective utility that determines price. Marshall was saying, it's like you guys are arguing which blade of the scissors does the cutting, and it's both blades. Okay, so Austrians don't like that analysis. Austrians like to say, no, it's subjective on both sides, because they're going to say, ultimately, the supply curve is not determined by objective cost considerations or technological constraints, because we've seen, you know, we can give you the price, the equilibrium price of barrels of fish against horses. And I didn't have anything in there about what it takes to breed a horse, you know, like how much oat, you know, how many oats and barley and whatever we got to feed the horse, and how much does that cost, or how much labor goes into feeding a horse and whatever, or going out and building a net and catching fish. The way we figured out the equilibrium price relationship between fish and horses was just consulting the subjective preference rankings of everybody in the market who had those things. And so the Austrians say the same thing applies to interest, that when you want to figure out what is the equilibrium interest rate, don't start talking to me about the productivity of capital investments, because that's what the mainstream thinks when it comes to interest. Mainstream economists following in the tradition of Irving Fisher. So Irving Fisher was like the godfather of the way mainstream neoclassicals now think of interest rates. Irving Fisher said, oh, there's like a supply and demand curve, and the demand is all about subjective time preference, that how much, you know, do I want to borrow money now, and how impatient am I? But he said the supply curve, I'm sorry, the other way around. The supply curve is about subjective factors, whereas the demand curve is about objective factors and, you know, would I want to borrow money in order to invest it in certain projects, and it depends on the rate of return I could get on those projects. And he said that has to do with physical things, like the what people mean by the productivity of capital. So that if I take resources and I don't devote them to present output, but I devote them to building a machine so that I can augment my labor down the road and then yield consumption in the future, typically I'm going to get a higher yield that way. And so if the yield there is going to be 8%, well, then I would be willing to borrow so long as the interest rate is lower than 8%. And so that goes into the demand for loanable funds, is this idea of the technological constraints and you know, the technological availabilities, our ability to physically transform present goods into future goods. Okay, so that's what's going on. So the Austrians, in the tradition of Mises and Rothbard and Walter Block and Hans Hoppe, say, no, that is totally wrong. You are making the same mistake that Alfred Marshall made when it came to explaining the price of fish versus horses. That, look what I just did, what Murray Rothbard just did. He explained the formation of the equilibrium interest rate, and there is nothing in here about our technological ability to not produce present consumption goods and instead devote those resources to the future and make a higher output of consumption goods in the future. All right, so that's, I'm telling you that just so you guys understand the context here of why Austrians are so dogmatic on this point, is because they're trying to distinguish themselves from the mainstream. So if you go into a mainstream PhD program, they're going to teach you that in equilibrium, the wage rate equals the marginal product of labor. Okay, and so as Austrians, we all agree with that, right, that in a competitive market, yep, the wage rate tends toward the marginal productivity of labor, okay. They're also going to teach you, in equilibrium, the interest rate equals the marginal product of capital. And because they're thinking of it, they think it's the same way. So the mainstream thinks that just as wages are the return to labor, interest is the return to capital. And again, they codify that by saying, well, yeah, because in a competitive market, a worker earns his marginal product, and they think in a competitive market, capital earns its marginal product, and that's what interest is. And so the Austrians are saying, no, it's not merely that that's a little bit off. They're saying that is completely a category mistake, that you're thinking of the wrong unit. That doesn't even make any sense, is what the hardline Austrians on this point will say. The interest is not the return to capital. Interest is is due to time preference. And that the most you can say is the technological considerations of capital's productivity, meaning the ability, your ability to produce more consumption goods if you first devote your resources to making tools and equipment and are willing to defer consumption. They're saying, at best, the way that works its way into the equation is that affects your subjective trade-off between present and future goods. That, you know, if you realize, oh, wait, because of these technological capabilities, if I abstain from present consumption and use those resources to make more machines and whatever, I can get 1,000 apples 2 years from now. Well, your knowledge of that might affect your willingness, your ranking of a present apple versus future apples, because now you're in a sense endowed with a greater supply of potential future apples, so you're richer. That might affect your trade-off. But the Austrian's point is, what determines the interest rate is your subjective trade-off between present and future goods. And capital only influences that indirectly by possibly altering how you compare present versus future goods. But when we try to say what is interest, it is wrong to say interest is the return to capital, because it's not. Interest has to do about time preference. There would be interest even if there were no capital. That's one way the Austrians put it. Even in a world without capital goods, even if you were like on a desert island and you just had, you know, you had your tree that was shooting out fruit, and you had a neighbor over there and his tree was going to start shooting out fruit, but not until next harvest. And so he said, hey, can you lend me some of your fruit today and I'll pay you some of my fruit next year when your tree is dead? You guys could make that mutually voluntary or mutually beneficial exchange, and you could compute, you know, the fruit rate of interest if you wanted. And there's nothing in there about capital productivity. That's just an intertemporal exchange. Just like if you had a ham sandwich and somebody else had a tuna fish sandwich and you wanted to trade, you could do that. Well, the same token, if you've got a bunch of present goods and not many future goods, and someone else has vice versa, and you guys engage in a trade, you know, that's the same thing, except there's time involved. And so the Austrians are saying, see, this is all about subjective preference. This has nothing intrinsically to do with the productivity of capital. Okay, so now we're back to the slide here. So what Mises' arguments to establish that time preference is, well, there's two things here. What I'm doing is I'm trying to explain why the Austrians think that time preference has to be positive. So remember, historically what happened is Frank Fetter was the first person to advance what we're now calling a pure time preference theory of interest. Fetter didn't call it that. He called it something else. So that was Fetter's theory. So Fetter cleaned up von Bawerk, took the insights of von Bawerk and just, in his mind, purified it, distilled it out, and got rid of the garbage, and said, nope, interest is about time preference, end of story. But Fetter thought that time preference itself was just an empirical thing. Or he thought, you know, maybe people have time preference because they're mortal, and you know, why do I want to have a pizza now instead of 300 years from now? Well, I'm going to be dead in 300 years, so duh. That kind of stuff. Or just, you know, biologically, maybe because the way we evolved, you know, the longer you wait, you could die. And so other things equal, you try to consume earlier and reproduce and pass your genes on, whatever. But Fetter thought that it was just an empirical fact about humans that they exhibit positive time preference. Mises took that and said, no, it's not really something about biological Homo sapiens. Time preference is intrinsic to action itself. That to view somebody as being an acting being implies that the person has positive time preference, that the person, other things equal, values a given satisfaction sooner rather than later. All right, so let me give you, so in human action, Mises gives some arguments as to why that's got to be true. Let me just give you two of them. So one is, you know, it's not really an airtight argument, but he's kind of just trying to appeal to your common sense and try to get you to see how weird it would be if people didn't have time preference. So he's saying, look, if you didn't have time preference, then you wouldn't have positive interest rates. But if you didn't have positive interest rates, think of what that would mean. It would mean that land couldn't sell for finite prices in terms of money. The only thing you could ever, the only way you could exchange land would be to exchange parcels of land for other parcels of land. Because land yields its services indefinitely. And so if you didn't discount the future at all, if you viewed, you know, so a given parcel of land, it's going to give you whatever, 100 bushels of cotton this year, 100 bushels next year, next year, next year, out until 30,000 years from now. And Mises is saying, if you didn't discount that, if you didn't view the bushels of wheat that were going to accrue to you from this land 10,000 years from now, if you value that the same as you value the bushels of cotton it's going to deliver to you today, then the land has infinite value. It's worth an infinite amount of cotton, of present cotton. And since present cotton has a price, that means the market value of that land right now is infinity. So you could maybe trade it to other people's, you know, other real estate owners could exchange land because you're trading things that are both infinite. But you could never trade land against something that is just a, you know, that isn't yielding an infinite supply of goods. All right, so Mises is saying that's crazy. The reason we all the time sell real estate against finite amounts of money is that we discount those future services. The fact that the land is going to yield wheat or whatever, cotton, 200 years from now, that is far less important to us in our estimation of its worth than the fact that it's going to yield cotton this year and next year and the next year, because we have time preference. Currently, we discount satisfactions that won't accrue until the far distant future. Okay, so that's one thing. Now the second argument here. So here now Mises is trying to just really drive home the point that time preference is intrinsic to action itself. So this isn't an empirical regularity. This doesn't have to do with our biological makeup. That by saying somebody is acting, that's the same thing as saying the person has time preference, or that implies the person has time preference. So what Mises says is, okay, he's going to try to do it like by a proof by contradiction. He's going to say, let's say there's an immortal being, and you're telling me he wants to achieve a certain end. He has a goal in mind. He has an end. He has a certain uneasiness that he wants to satisfy by using a means to achieve an end, so he wants to act, but you're telling me he doesn't have time preference. So Mises says, okay, so here we've got this immortal being, and right now he's faced with a choice. He could satisfy the end today, or he could wait and think about doing it tomorrow. So if you're telling me that other things equal, he doesn't want to do it today rather than waiting, well then look what happens. So he doesn't do it today because, you know, he doesn't want to. We let a day go by. Now, if we held everything else equal, and he's faced with the same choice, do you want to satisfy the end today or wait? And you're telling me he doesn't care. He doesn't have any desire to do it sooner rather than later, so he waits. Well, we just keep doing that. So the being never actually satisfies that end. And so Mises is saying, see, that's why if you're telling me somebody wants to achieve an end, you know, that he has a felt uneasiness that he wants to satisfy, then I'm saying, okay, what you just implied then is that other things equal, he wants to satisfy that sooner rather than later. Because if he didn't, that's tantamount to saying he doesn't actually want to satisfy that end at all. All right, so you can see the depth of Mises' thinking on this. Like, that's where he's going with it, and that's why he thinks it's so intrinsic to action itself. That this isn't just a thing about, oh yeah, people get hungry, and if you don't eat something in the present and you don't get some shelter and clothing, you're going to die. So rationally, people have some time preference at some margin. I mean, that's the kind of way Fetter was arguing, and Mises is saying, no, it's much more fundamental than that. Okay, so let's move on. I need to jump ahead because I just got to remind myself of what I've got in this thing. Okay. Oops. Okay, so now we are on slide C, the alleged counterexample. So let me just explain to you, and again, I'm giving you guys here the canonical Austrian take on this stuff. Okay, so this ice example. So the point is, the Austrians lay out their theory of the pure time preference theory of interest. They say interest is about the fact that people prefer to consume sooner rather than later, or they prefer present goods to future goods. And so then the critics say, wait a minute. It's fine for you to say that in general people have that, but surely you Austrians don't mean that they always do, because we can come up with all kinds of counterexamples. So let me walk through some of these and tell you how the believer in the pure time preference theory of interest. Well, I should clarify something. Strictly speaking, you could endorse the pure time preference theory of interest and not believe that time preference, positive time preference, is an implication of action. So Israel Kirzner, for example, endorses the pure time preference theory of interest. He thinks that to explain the market rate of interest, why is the interest rate positive? It's because people have positive time preference. But he thinks in principle time preference could be negative. He just thinks it's an empirical regularity that people are impatient and they would rather consume sooner rather than later, at least on the margin. Whereas he doesn't, and I asked him in his office, I said, you know, what do you think about Mises' arguments here in Human Action, where he's establishing in his mind that time preference is a necessary feature of human action, and Kirzner just said something like, I never understood Mises that. I didn't know what he was doing there. Right, so he wasn't saying Mises was wrong. He was just saying, I don't get what he's doing in those sections of human action, and I'm not going to worry about it, because we all know empirically people, by and large, have positive time preference. So what's, you know, Kirzner thought, why are we wasting our time on this stuff, whether it's a priori true or just a posteriori true, who cares? It is true in this world, and that's how we explain interest rates. So that's Kirzner's position. So to be clear here, I should actually say more precisely, I'm going to give you what the believers in the a priori existence of time preference think. Okay, so people will say, wait a minute, you guys are nuts. It's not true that people always prefer present goods to future goods. What if, you know, we picture a guy in the winter and we say to him, hey, I can give you 5 bags of ice right now, or I can give you 4 bags of ice to be delivered in the summer. Which do you choose? Well, he might choose to have the 4 bags of ice delivered in the summer. So there, he's choosing to get a lower quantity of future goods over present goods. So, duh. You know, they're clearly the person is exhibiting a premium on future goods over present goods. All right, so the way Rothbard or Walter Block handles that is just to say those aren't the same goods. That when we say time preference means present goods are preferred to future goods, we obviously mean the same type of good. It's got to be the same good. So, for example, I wouldn't be violating the law of time preference. You know, nobody would be stupid enough to say, oh, you Austrians say you believe that people prefer present to future goods. Well, what if I said to a guy, I'll give you, let me think for a minute here. I'll give you 2 Volvos right now, or I'll give you 1 Lamborghini 6 months from now. Which do you choose? And the person says, oh, give me the 1 Lamborghini 6 months from now. Aha, you Austrians are idiots. The person chose to get 1 future car instead of 2 present cars. So you guys are morons, right? If somebody said that, that would clearly be silly. That wouldn't be a valid counterexample, because a Lamborghini, even though you can call it a car and you can call Volvos a car, those aren't the same cars. The Lamborghini is clearly a better good than the Volvos are. And so that's no violation. So by the same token, to say to somebody, hey, I can give you one bag of ice in the summer, or I give you 2 bags of ice right now, and right now we're in the middle of December, which do you prefer? If I pick the bag of ice in the summer, that's not a violation of the law of time preference, because ice to me when it's really hot out is a different good from ice when it's freezing outside. All right, so that's the way they handle that. there's different takes on it. Like you could the fireworks here. You could imagine asking somebody in March and say, hey, I can give you a bunch of fireworks right now, or I can give you a bunch of fireworks on July 3rd. What do you want? You can imagine the person saying, give them to me on July 3rd, because you know you don't want to be storing fireworks for all those months. And you know if you're going to have fireworks, you're going to shoot them off on the 4th of July. So it's the same thing. The Austrians would say those are different goods, that shooting off fireworks on the 4th of July gives you more utility than shooting off fireworks in the middle of March, and so they're really not the same good. And so the fact that you would prefer delivery of fireworks from your vantage point in March in the future rather than getting it right away, that doesn't mean anything. That's you're comparing apples and oranges. Okay, now a more interesting one, the reason I got this guy getting mugged here is you can imagine scenarios in which there would be a contractual negative nominal rate of interest. All right, so normally we think that's impossible, but that's just under regular circumstances. You can easily imagine people being willing to lend money in exchange for getting paid back less than the principal. So if you're about to go through a real dangerous area and you've got $1,000 in cash on you and you're walking next to, you know, your buddy who's a police officer and, you know, he's in full uniform and everything, you're thinking, okay, these gang members are probably going to mess with me a lot more than they're going to mess with him. So you might say, you know, suppose for some reason you're going to get separated and you got to go through the dangerous neighborhood, but then an hour later he's got to go through the dangerous neighborhood too. You might say, hey, let me lend you $1,000 now, and then tomorrow when we meet up again after we get to the dangerous neighborhood, you'll give me back $900. Do you agree to that? And, you know, he presumably would say yes. So I'm doing it. You know, that makes sense from my point of view. So in a certain, you know, if you wanted to classify it like that, you could say I was lending out $1,000 to only get paid back $900. But, I, you know, the typical, I think Rothbardian would handle that and say, no, that's not really a pure loan contract. What's going on there is you're paying him $100 to transport your money through the dangerous neighborhood. That's really what's going on there, and it's misleading to classify that as a pure exchange of present for future money. So, you know, and there's all kinds of other examples you can think of, and that's the way the Austrians deal with that kind of stuff. So if you're, if we're on an island and we have a bunch of fruit and stuff, but then we think there's going to be a crop failure, and there's going to be a famine next year, you can imagine somebody saying, oh, here, let me give you 100 apples right now, and then next year just pay me back 50 apples. And so in one sense, that's like a negative interest rate in terms of real, you know, a negative real interest rate. But the Austrians just say, well, other things aren't equal there, that the margin utility of the apples is going to go way up when there's the famine. Okay, so that's the standard way Austrians deal with alleged counterexamples. All right, let me just hit two more points, and then I'll turn over to your questions. Rothbard, I touched on this during the lecture last week, but I did it kind of quickly, and this is a crucial point, so let me go over it again, and Rothbard was making the same point in Chapter 6, that the way a mainstream economist would looks at the economy and the way they compute gross domestic product. So gross domestic product, if you think about what the equation is, it's GDP equals C plus I plus G plus net exports. So in this little hypothetical economy, we don't have the government and we don't have exports or imports, so get rid of those terms. So the way a standard mainstream macroeconomist would look at this economy here in slide number 5 is you would say, okay, the only thing going on potentially is consumption and investment. And I am saying that they would look at this and classify this in terms of their measurements. They would say the real or the nominal GDP in this economy is 100 ounces of gold worth of output every period. And they would say 100% of output in this economy is due to consumer spending and 0% is due to investment. And why is that? Because investment in the GDP formula refers to net investment. It means investment over and above what you need just to maintain the capital structure in its current configuration. So specifically from an individual firm's point of view, when you run through your business operations, your capital your physical capital physically depreciates. That, you know, it gets run down. Like if it's a machine, it starts to run down, it gets worn away, or if it's goods in process, you know, they're gone. And so each period, if the firm wants to just return to its original configuration, it needs to invest some money back in the business. So if it's, you know, like let's say there's a machine that costs $1 million up front and it lasts for 10 years. Well, that means every year the firm has to, on its books, write down the value of the machine by $100,000. So there's $100,000 of depreciation on that machine every year. Now, actually, that would be true if the interest rate were 0%. All right. So if you're a purist out there, I'm acknowledging that, but I'm trying to keep the number simple. Okay. So because, again, what's going on there is you're a business. You know, let's say you're a bakery, and you get flour every period, and then you use it to, you know, roll in the dough, and then you bake the bread, and then ship the bread to the wholesaler, who then, you know, puts it in the plastic bag and whatever. Well, every period you don't buy a brand new oven. Let's say the oven lasts for 10 years, and you spend $1 million on it. Because it's a humongous oven, and you got an industrial size process going on. So the point is, every 10 years you got to spend $1 million getting a brand new oven. But that's just to tread water. That's just to keep your operation afloat, doing the same thing year in and year out. And so the way mainstream economists classify that in terms of the GDP statistics is. It gets into a little bit of a trick. I think actually when they do buy the brand new oven, they count that. So it's actually inconsistent, and Rothbard does talk about this. But for sure, when they buy the flour, and then the flour, you know, they turn into bread and sell it. They don't count buying the flour as an investment. That does not go into the I component of GDP. Okay, so the investment section of GDP refers to net investment. And so it's missing out on all of these expenditures. So in this economy, like I say, There is an inconsistency. I was actually even going to write a paper on this at some point. So I think when you talk about net investment, it's tricky. Because I do believe if a firm spent $1 million getting a brand new oven, that would go into GDP for that year. And then they wouldn't, you know, the depreciation of the $100,000, that wouldn't do anything up till then, you know, in the subsequent years. But they wouldn't count them spending money on the flour. All right, so anyway, even though really that's just a difference of timing, and you would think, you know, over a 10-year period, you should count it all as the same thing or not, and yet they treat it differently. And so I think that's just a problem with their treatment. But anyway, the point is, in this economy, I'm quite certain the way the mainstream economists would classify this is they say this is due 100% to consumer spending. There is no investment going on the way we measure investment in this economy. And so they would say that, yeah, this is propped up by consumer spending. If consumers ever started trying to save more, this economy would collapse because it represents 100% of their output. And Rothbard's point is that's crazy. Yes, ultimately, an economy is always geared towards final consumption. That's why we do everything. That's why we are, you know, engaging in 30-year processes where we're mining precious minerals and stuff, and then we're going to use them in a thing and pass it along through several stages until 30 years from now, consumer goods come out. We're ultimately always doing everything for consumption, but it's not right to say that consumer spending is what drives the economy, and it's certainly not right to look at consumer spending compared to net investment to try to figure out their relative importance. That in this economy, really, there's every period, there's 418 ounces that are spent acquiring goods, and only 100 of them are spent by the final consumer. 318 ounces are spent by entrepreneurs every period, either as payments to original factors or as purchases of capital, of you know, capital goods. All right, so that's what Rothbard's point is there. Oh, let me just say one more thing here. So here, if you had that Keynesian mentality and thought, oh my gosh, this economy is driven 100% by consumer savings or consumer spending, you know, what happens if this third level capitalist here decides, why am I every period spending 60 ounces of gold buying stuff from the guy before me and then spending another 17 or 16 ounces in order to wait a year and sell the thing for 80? I'm going to stop doing that. I'm going to take my 76 ounces, and instead of investing in the business, I'm just going to go out and try to buy more consumer goods with it. If he did that, well, two periods from now, we're going to have a crash in output. You know, we'll get by one more period, because remember I'm saying it's this guy that does that. So next period, we're fine, because next period, we still got this guy at the stage before who spent the 80 and the 15 to get goods that just need one more period of work before they turn into 100 ounces worth of consumer goods. So it's not going to hit right away, but the next period is going to hit. If this guy just takes a year off and doesn't spend his 76 ounces doing what he's always been doing, that's going to move down the pipeline, and then that means next period this guy's not going to have anything to work with. He's not going to be able to spend 80 ounces getting the capital goods from the previous guy, because the previous guy just stopped working. He stopped doing it. And then that means next period, these people aren't going to get 100 ounces worth of consumer goods. All right, so you can see how it's crucial that these people, these capitalist entrepreneurs at these various stages, keep doing what they're doing, keep plowing back the lion's share of their revenue back into the business to repeat it for next period. Because if any one of them ever stops, then you're going to have a gap in the pipeline. And as that moves down, eventually when that hits the consumer level, you're not going to have any consumption goods that period, and everyone's going to starve. Okay, the last thing, I alluded to it before, but let me just go over it one more time quickly. So this is the standard way that a mainstream textbook would explain the determination of interest rates. They would say, yep, there's a supply curve of savings, and so that's, you know, people have income, and they can either consume it or they can save it and lend it out to businesses. And the higher the interest rate is, the more likely you are to save and, you know, defer your consumption, because the reward on the margin is higher for doing that, so you're willing to save a higher fraction of your income and lend it out to businesses. On the other hand, there's the demand curve for savings. So some of it is for just consumption loans. That's true. So some people just want to go out and buy a car or buy, you know, a yacht or whatever, take a cruise, live beyond their means, and then pay it back in the future. So that's part of it. But also part of what constitutes the demand for loanable funds is on the part of businesses, that they want to borrow funds and then invest it productively. And the standard, you know, so why is this downward sloping an I? You know, the lower the interest rate, why does the quantity demanded of loanable funds go up? And they'll say, oh, well, because businesses have this whole schedule of investment opportunities. And, you know, they see that they could buy resources for a certain price, get them going on a certain process, and then sell the output down the road, and they could earn a certain rate of return. And so depending on the rates of return that are available in these investment projects, businesses will borrow more or less depending on the interest rate. So if the interest rate is 8%, businesses will only borrow funds and then invest in projects that yield more than 8%. But if the interest rate drops to 4%, now businesses will still borrow and invest in all the processes, you know, projects yielding more than 8%, but they'll also do the same thing for projects that have an internal rate of return of 4% or higher. And so you're gaining, so there are more, so in other words, once you rank all your investment projects and look at and calculate what the internal rates of return are, obviously the threshold, the cutoff is going to include more projects the lower the interest rate is. And so that's why the mainstream economist would say the lower the interest rate, other things equal, the higher the quantity demanded of loanable funds. And so then they think, okay, so now we know why people save and why that's upward sloping. We know why people borrow and that's downward sloping. You slap the two together, and then you get the equilibrium interest rate. Problem solved. And so Rothbard is saying this is nonsense, that where are these investment schedules coming from? Where are these internal rates of return coming from? He's saying it's coming from something like this, that a business person can look at the prices at various stages and say, if I jump in at this stage and I spend 60 on capital goods and 16 on land and labor factors, that means a total outlay of 76, and then 1 year later I can sell the product for 80. So that means I can make an interest return of 4 ounces on my investment of 76. So 4 divided by 76 is my internal rate of return on this project. And so if the market interest rate is above a certain amount, I would, you know, not borrow. And if it's below that amount, I'd borrow and jump in here. And Rothbard is saying that's, you're completely missing the point. The reason these spreads exist is time preference. That if the rate of interest, so it's wrong to think that the interest rate is, that these spreads are just whatever they are. That, you know, this happens to be 60 and that happens to be 16 and that happens to be 80, and that's some objective fact out there that there's that rate of return on jumping into the third order, you know, the third stage here. And then thinking this, so this information then goes into the computation or the derivation of the demand for loanable funds, and then you got to put people's willingness to save and then come up, well, what's the market rate of interest? Rothbard saying, no. That information, you know, the people's willingness to provide present money in exchange for the promise of future money at various margins, he said that is what causes these numbers to be what they are in the first place. That if people had a lower, if people had a lower time preference, then these numbers would be higher because they know, the person knows at this stage I could spend 60 and 16 for 76 total and sell the product for 80. So the point is, why aren't those numbers getting bid up? Remember, that was Bombaverick's way of framing the problem. Why aren't entrepreneurs paying 61 for this thing and paying 17 for the land and labor factors since they know they can sell the output for 80? And the answer is, Rothbard says, because of their time preferences. They're not willing to give up more than that. And so Rothbard's saying it's wrong to think the interest rate is determined in the loanable funds market, which in turn is based on these price spreads. He's saying, no, it is people's preference rankings in the time market, the stuff we did at the beginning of this lecture, that determines both these numbers and this kind of thing. That the market for just pure money loans. And so that's why Rothbard thinks that, you know, this is where we really see the interest rate pinned down, is in the product markets, and that is an offshoot. If you're actually just literally lending out money or borrowing money at a contractual rates of interest, well, that's going to be the same number, but it's because they're both driven by time preference. It's not because one... It's not because this causes the product markets. And also, like I say, Austrians do tend to think that this is more fundamental. Okay, well, why don't I stop there, and then let me just devote 5 minutes to your questions, because I have to go pick up my son. So sorry, I don't mean to keep going over time. It's just there's a lot of material. I'll try to limit myself to an hour and 15 next time. Okay, Steven says, please give your critique of the pure time preference theory of interest. You should just read it. It's in my dissertation. I'll post that if I haven't already. So I'm going to post a link in response to Steven's question that gives links to two papers where I exhaustively go through what my problem is with certain aspects of this, but I'm not going to even talk about it now because it's going to confuse people. So in this class, you know, my purpose isn't to talk about interest theory. The purpose is to teach you what Rothbard is saying, a man, economy, and state. So if you want to argue with me in the forum, that's fine, but I'm just saying I'm not going to, during the standard class time, go into it. Okay, Matt, I'm going to butcher your last name, Zietzky, says, I'm having trouble with the conception of a unit of a good being different goods at different times. As an example, a given unit of ice would seem to me to be the same good in both summer and in winter, as it is the same means to a given end, the end being, say, cooling a glass of water. But in summer, the desire and thus expected benefit for ice is higher than in winter due to the varying temperatures. Why are the same units of ice in summer versus winter called different goods when it would seem that the subjective preferences of consumers towards the given good is all that has changed? Well, this is, I'm in an awkward position here because I agree with you, but let me, so what I'm going to do is tell you what I think Rothbard or Walter Block would say. They would say, look, it's not the way we as subjectivists explain goods, it's not really due to their intrinsic properties, right? So it's, if you look at different ice cubes, and one of them, you know, is slightly more volume than the other one, we still might call them successive units of ice, and they're the same, you know, the units of the same good, even though they are physically and chemically different, because they can both satisfy the same ends. All right, so that, so I mean, we're establishing that they do, that it's not the physical properties per se that pins down whether the thing is the same good or not, okay? And then they're going to say, okay, so now the ice in the summer, I mean, that just can give you different satisfactions, right? It can satisfy more urgent needs than the ice in the winter can, because the ice in the summer can alleviate your thirst when you're really dehydrated and sweating like crazy, and so it's more important to you. So relieving your thirst or your body warmth when it's 100 degrees out is a different thing from relieving it when it's not 100 degrees out. And so those are different goods, just like that first glass of water is satisfying a more urgent need than a 10th glass of water. Even if you decided to drink both of them, the first one is more important to you than the 10th one, because you know you're just in a different physical state at that point. And so by the same token, having ice in the summertime, that ice can deliver to you more benefits than having ice in the wintertime. So since the ice in the summer can satisfy ends that the ice in the winter can't satisfy, that's why we're, as subjectivists, we're saying those are different goods. All right, so that's, I think that's what Rothbard and Walter Block would say. Okay, Stephen Davis then says, this is the last question, in my debates with free bankers, they have said that Austrians place too much importance on the present goods versus future goods distinction. Can you explain why this might be? Well, free bankers, for those of you who don't know, that means guys like George Selgin and Larry White who think that there's nothing intrinsically wrong with fractional reserve banking. So they agree that the Fed's awful. They don't like fiat money produced by the government, blah, blah, blah. They want to have a competitive market, free market, money and banking. But they're saying in such a world, banks could issue fiduciary media, could issue, could give loans to their customers in excess of what they have on deposit in the vault. And so Stephen is saying that when he argues with them, they're claiming, I guess, Rothbardians place too much importance on present goods versus future goods distinction. Why would they say that? I'm not sure why they would say that. I've never seen that issue come up. My guess would be one of the arguments that people like Walter Block use to try to cast aspersions on fractional reserve banking is to say, look, if I want to, as a bank, take a loan from a customer, like he lends me the money at 2%, and then I go and lend that money out to somebody else at 4%, that's fine. Because there, the person has given up the present good in exchange for a future good. And so there's not two people trying to own the same thing at the same time. But what is illegitimate, Walter Block says, is that when a customer deposits money into a demand account, like a checking account, where he thinks that's still his money, and then I, as the banker, the fractional reserve banker, take half of that and go lend it out to somebody else at a higher interest rate. Block says that's illegitimate because if that initial customer is treating that as part of his present money stockpile, how then can I, as the fractional reserve banker, have given it to somebody else? Because now you got two people thinking the same money is theirs right now. And so I think maybe then to evade that objection, some of the free bankers you're arguing with are saying, well, who cares about this philosophical? Is it present money or future money? Who cares? That would be my guess. Okay, well, why don't we stop there? Remember to do your quiz if you're taking the class for credit, and I will announce all that stuff later on. And we will have office hours this week. Incidentally, I don't know if some of you had trouble. Last week I was around for the office hours, but my computer was acting funny, and it took me a minute to get it up and open. And so I don't know if that was the issue, but I'm getting mixed up. But one of my classes, for one session, nobody showed up for, and I don't know if it was this one or the other class I'm teaching. But anyway, if you were trying to log in and couldn't, it was just because my computer was being finicky, and I opened the thing up like 3 minutes after. But anyway, I will open it up well in advance this coming time to make sure there's no problems like that.